This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, investigative journalist Patrick O'Connor joins us to talk about his new book, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper.
Cooper, who was convicted of the murder but framed, is still on death row some 25 years later in California.
We'll talk with attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard about spying on protesters and the general crackdown on dissent.
She and her partner, Carl Massinio, are headquartered in the belly of the beast in Washington, D.C., doing very good work for people in D.C. and really around the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, we have some sad news. We've lost a longtime Guild member and champion for farm workers, the underserved, Karen Dedamore, Philadelphia-based lawyer.
I know. You know, I've seen her at Lawyers Guild convictions. It was very sad to hear the news.
Karen began her political work inspired by the anti-Vietnam protests while she was a student at Bryn Mawr College. Her husband, Harold Jordan, said that she lived out of, quote, a concern about the plight of abused low-wage workers. It was a personal passion. We honored Karen last year at the Philadelphia Guild Convention. You may remember we gave her our Ernie Goodman Award for her many accomplishments. She was a beloved person as well as a really effective attorney, former legal worker. In January 1976, the Philadelphia Daily News report stated that deaths and woundings of civilians involving police officers had decreased in 1975 compared to 1974. And they quoted Karen suggesting that publicity by her agency, the Philadelphians for Equal Justice, had actually contributed to that decline.
Karen Dedamore was only 62 years old. She died of rheumatoid arthritis, and she received the National Lawyers Guild Award last year in a wheelchair.
Karen will be deeply missed by many. Michael, we have an update that I think is significant because it falls into the category of big business trying to regulate internet speech.
Really censorship, but in a new form. We're not talking about newspapers here, but still very effective.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation filed an amicus brief with the Ninth Circuit recently. And basically, it was urging the court not to give in to disgruntled businesses who basically want to sidestep federal law. In this case, it involves the website Yelp.com, where reviewers of businesses, restaurants, can post reviews. And what's happening is that big business, when they get bad reviews, is trying to pressure Yelp.com and other social networking and user reviewer sites. They're holding them responsible for the reviews. Now, a law was passed, the Communications Decency Act, to protect, to immunize Yelp.coms of the world for this kind of liability for bad reviews generated by third parties. What we have here, and in their brief, the Electronic Frontier Foundation said, we have speculation and conjecture that Yelp was responsible for the ads, because I guess the businesses are saying Yelp employees and personnel generated some of the negative ads. But they haven't proven that. The judge in an earlier case denied to hold them responsible and said they were protected by the CDA.
Yeah, well, it's a good law and it was a good ruling. Can't go censoring the internet like that. Even though it may hurt big business, they should take their lumps if they deserve them or not. If somebody has a sincerely held belief and wants to publish that on the internet, that's their right.
Let's hope that the judge in the future does the right thing with this. Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper is the title of investigative journalist Patrick O'Connor's new book. This is a fact-filled chronicle of death row inmate Kevin Cooper's trial and conviction in 1985. When O'Connor committed to writing the book, he pored over thousands of case documents from trial transcripts, autopsy photos, and judicial rulings. He interviewed those involved in the trial and appeals process to unravel an all-too-familiar scenario in which police and prosecution withheld and destroyed evidence that would have exonerated Cooper from the murders of the Ryan family. Patrick O'Connor joins us today to tell us more about this frame-up. He's the editor of CrimeMagazine.com and also the author of The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He has previously worked as a reporter for UPI, editor of Cincinnati Magazine, associate editor of TV Guide, and editor and publisher of the Kansas City New Times. Patrick O'Connor, welcome back to Law & Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's great to be back.
Many of us really loved the book that you wrote, The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and so we were quite excited to hear that you've written a new one titled Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper. Kevin Cooper's name may not be as familiar as Mumia, but I think certainly people in the death penalty community are aware of his case. Tell us briefly, before we get into the details, how you came to be involved in this.
Well, in 2008, the Mumia book that I wrote came out, and I was in the San Francisco Bay Area with Jeff Mackler of the Mobilization to Free Mumia. We had about 15 venues that we went to all over the Bay Area, and invariably, supporters of Kevin Cooper would come to these events, and afterwards would take me aside and say that you've got to write a book about Kevin Cooper, that his case is a lot different than Mumia's, but there are many similarities to it in the terms of the framing of him. San Francisco Bay Area must have 100 or 200 writers who could have done this book. Now, I live in Naples, Florida. It wasn't the easiest proposition for me to accept it, but they were really persistent. And once I started reading the transcripts from the trial, I could see there was a lot of things wrong in this case. And so I took it up. It took me about 2.5 years to go from the start to the publication of the book.
Tell us about the facts of this case. There was a murder.
There was a terrible, brutal murder. A family in Chino Hills. This is Arabian horse country. This family named the Ryans. They live on a hilltop house with a very big spread, 15 Arabians. Horses.
California, northern, southern? Where is it?
San Bernardino County, 45 miles east of Los Angeles. San Bernardino County was cut out of the vast expanses of Los Angeles County. And it's the biggest county in the lower 48 states by far. It's bigger than 9 states in the United States. But in this little section of this little niche of the county called Chino Hills, it was at the time about 25,000 people, very sparsely populated, and most of the people were either raising horses or grazing cattle, that kind of thing. And this family was a mom and dad that were both chiropractors, 41-year-old chiropractors, and they had a 10-year-old daughter named Jessica, and an 8.5-year-old son named Josh. And the night of the murders, a friend of Josh's, 11-year-old Christopher Hughes, spent the night. And around midnight that night, the home was breached, the master bedroom, and the family was assaulted with an axe or a hatchet, and I think 2 knives and an ice pick. And it was an incredible fight. These people just didn't stand in line and say, I'm next. The father, Doug, was, as I said, 41 years old, 6'1", 190 pounds, a former Marine, MP in the Marines, and could take care of himself. And the mother was 5'8", very strong. She was the one that trained the horses, these enormous Arabians that she could control. So, and both of them kept loaded weapons in the bedroom. So the whole idea that one perpetrator would use or even could use 4 weapons to perpetrate this attack is kind of facetious on its face.
Because victims weren't tied up.
No, there was no binding of any victim. Doug made it from the side of the bed he slept on to the side on foot, from his side of the bed to his wife's side of the bed, He was attacked there, and his I hate to talk about this, but his arterial blood spray was on the wife's side of the bed, and then he made it back where he is found on his side of the bed within 2 feet of his loaded rifle. This is where his body is found. Now, what put Kevin Cooper in the crosshairs of this whole thing was 3 miles away from Chino Hills is Chino, which is home to the California Institute for Men, an enormous maximum, minimum, and medium security prison, where every felon in Southern California is sent for classification. So Cooper was sent there on the basis of two burglaries in Los Angeles. They had fouled up his paperwork. When he was arrested, he was carrying the ID of another, of a person whose ID he had stolen in Pennsylvania, where Kevin's from. Kevin's from Pittsburgh. And he went by the name of David Troutman, and he was arrested under that name. And even though he told the people that his real name was Kevin Cooper, they kept calling him, treating him as David Troutman. So when they were doing the classification for Cooper, who had escaped once from on a work detail from a prison in Pennsylvania, and he had escaped once from a mental hospital where he was under pre-sentencing evaluation. So he's the kind of person you'd put in maximum security because he's a high escape risk. They kept looking at David Troutman's records, and therefore Troutman only had no record at all except for these two burglaries in Los Angeles, so they put him in minimum. The day after this classification, the next morning, Kevin escapes. Just walks out the prison ground, steps through a hole in a fence, makes his way to a lumber yard where he holds up for 5-6 hours, waits for it to get dark. He escaped around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at dark, he winds his way through these across a couple of state highways, and then starts coming up to Chino Hills, to this Arabian horse country. And that's all that's there, are these as one ranch after another. He climbs up the steep hill, and he sees a garage door, lights on a garage door, and he could see that the door is slightly ajar. So he goes over and opens the door, looks in, there's nobody there, and there he holds up. He holds up in this house for the next 2 days, and this house is located 125 yards below the steep hill where the Ryans live on top of the hill. So that put him, when they found, 3 days later, they found his prints all over this house. This escaped convict's prints all over the house. They zeroed in on him as the perpetrator.
Basically, evidence was not turned over to the defense attorneys. That's what we call a Brady violation. It's a constitutional violation that in many cases is grounds for a new trial. There was a young child survived, I understand it, yes. And testified that there were two white males who perpetrated the crime.
Well, he didn't testify to that, Heidi, but when he was found around noon, the family was murdered on a Saturday night around midnight. The father of one of the boy who slept over came over to check out why his son hadn't come home. He was supposed to go to Mass at 9 o'clock. So when he came over, first the wife came over, and she couldn't penetrate the house. And then she sent her husband over, and he looked through the master bedroom, and he saw what he thought was like some crazy game gone bad. You know, like they'd been playing with, that stuff you shoot on each other.
Paint.
Or something.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe what he was seeing, but he could see that Josh, the young boy, the 8-and-a-half-year-old boy, he was moving slightly in this room. Everyone else was long dead. But Josh had had his throat slashed from ear to ear. He had been hit in the back with a hatchet, stabbed in the front, and left for dead. He, by all rights, should have been dead. They certainly thought he was dead. So he's airlifted to a Loma Linda hospital by helicopter. In the emergency room, he cannot speak because his vocal cords have been slashed. But they devise a system through a chart of all the letters of the alphabet and the numbers 1 through 9, and then the words yes and no. And so through this process, they discern from him that the attackers of his family and him were three young white men. And interestingly, that night, around midnight, a family, this is horse country, so a family had just dropped a trainer off on the only street that goes down out of, away from the Ryan's house. There's only one road there, one road up and back. So they're attempting to exit this driveway, and they have to stop because there's this car coming, hurtling down the road. And the people look in, the husband and wife, they look in the car and they see three white guys driving what in fact is the Ryan's stolen station wagon. So they report this information the next day. So we had the little boy telling the ER personnel, and there were a lot of them, and also a deputy sheriff was there, and he told the deputy sheriff through a squeeze method, hand squeeze deal, that it was three white men. And then these people call up and say they see three white men driving the Ryan's stolen station wagon. So the cops had this right away, the three white guys, and they put out APBs for three white guys. But when they discern that Kevin Cooper's prints are all over this hideout house, they switch. They just start discarding that information and start planting evidence that would implicate Cooper, start destroying evidence that would have exonerated him, and then fabricating and making big lies about stuff to implicate him. So that's the process they use.
We're speaking with Patrick O'Connor about his new book, Scapegoat, The Chino Hill Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper. So as Heidi was saying, we were looking at what happened at the actual trial, but I just want to get the time frame again. The murders were June 1985.
1983.
And Kevin Cooper was, at least during the time when the people in the house were killed, as an escape prisoner, staying in a house about 125 yards down the hill.
That's right.
And so that's at least initially why they perhaps fixated on Kevin Cooper.
It is.
You've just brought out a lot of evidence as to
why. The eyewitness evidence was so contrary to that there were two reports of three white men responsible for this.
And also, if I may interrupt, as you've described the scenario, we have two fit adults, and the weapon use sort of indicated that it would be difficult for one person to kill both of those adults with the kind of fight they had.
That's
would
right.
Implicate more than one person.
What year was the trial?
1985.
So let's talk about that a little more. You've talked a little about the evidence, or if you want to talk more about that, but what was the trial?
I want to mention one other piece of evidence that figures heavily in this case. The very day that the sheriff of San Bernardino County named Kevin Cooper as the lone perpetrator, a woman in Mentrone, which is 45 miles away from Chino Hills, she calls up the sheriff's substation. This is, as I said, the biggest county in the United States. She calls up one of 10 substations. It's called Yucaipa. And they send out a property. She says, I've got some bloody coveralls in my walk-in closet that were left here by my boyfriend the other night, and I think they're connected to the Chino Hills murders. And one of the reasons I think they are, they're caked in blood, and they have Arabian horsehair around the pant legs. So the property deputy, he goes out. He's impressed with what he sees, and he calls his superior out, and they take these coveralls out and put them on the hood of the squad car, and then they bag them. And the woman says, I really would like to talk up to a homicide detective about what I know about my boyfriend. I've got a lot more to tell you, but I want to tell it to a homicide detective. Well, they never call her. This is the day they've identified Kevin Cooper. Had they called her, she would have said, my boyfriend is a convicted murderer. He had just been out a year, killed a 17-year-old girl, chopped her body up into parts, dumped them in a canal, and her body parts were never found. He admits to this crime, and he turned state's evidence against a guy named Clarence Ray Allen, the last man executed in California, by the way, 2006. And for that, he gets to plead to second-degree murder, even though he is the murderer. And so about a year before this, he's released from his 4.5 years of incarceration for this murder of this young girl. All right, she would have told him that. She would have told him that. That next day, she went out to the washroom in the back, this back porch they have, to check his tool belt and saw that all of his tools were there except for his hatchet. And then her third thing she would have said was, He was no longer, when he came home that night, he was wearing these coveralls, and he was no longer wearing this tan T-shirt that I laid out for him this morning that he wore when the last time I saw him. And she said, I can tell you that this tan T-shirt is Fruit of the Loom, medium size, and has a pocket in front. Well, 2 days after the murders, the police actually find this exact tan T-shirt outside a bar. There's a bar about a mile and a half down the road from where the Ryans lived, and these morons, after doing this murder, went to the bar. And they are really strung out. They're obnoxious. One of them has his head laying down on the table. He can't even lift it. And the bar manager comes over and says, well, what's wrong with your friend? And they said, oh, he's had a really hard night. There are three very attractive women in this bar, and these guys, they perk up a little bit. Two of them approach the women. One of the women is a phlebotomist, the person who draws blood. And she says to these two guys who approach, she says, I hope you realize this. You probably don't, but you're covered in blood. You've got blood all over your face. Your clothes are got blood on them. What's the deal with you guys? And they give a very funny look to this. Now, and they soon depart. The first day after the murders, a woman driving by the bar, this is big news. This is the biggest crime in San Bernardino history, in the history of the entire county. It's as big as the Tate-LaBianca murders, and it was as vicious and brutal, if not more so, than those murders. It was a shocking deal. So this woman, she sees on the side of the road outside the bar a blue T-shirt. It's a blue T-shirt that looks like it has blood on it, so she pulls over. Yeah, it's got blood on it. She calls up the sheriff. This dispatcher sends a deputy out, and he collects the shirt at like 4:34, logged into the dispatcher's log. And so that raises their curiosity about the bar, and they send the cops out the next day, and they find this tan T-shirt, this Fruit of the Loom size medium tan T-shirt. So we've got these two T-shirts. So all this stuff that they're getting is killing their theory that one perpetrator did this. Everything that they keep stumbling across goes the other way, that it's multiple perpetrators. I mean, the number of weapons, the fact that these people, they sustained so many defensive wounds. These people fought for a long time before they were killed. During this onslaught, the little girl, she makes it outside the house. Now, this really kills the theory of the one perpetrator because there's two loaded guns in the room, and we know that the mother was still alive before the daughter died because the mother's blood pattern, she's like holding the girl, pressing her to her breast, and there's dripping from the mother down to as though the mother had stood over her first. So we know that from the coroner's report and the medical examiner that at some point the mother was alive when the girl wasn't. So this shows you, if she made it outside, which she did, she made it outside the house, that while she's gone, the mother would be free to get the gun and shoot these people. So those are the kind of things that they just had to keep ignoring, one after the other.
Well, Patrick, why did the police ignore such compelling evidence, focus in on Kevin Cooper rather than the two white males, and really steer things so that he had a conviction? Is it because he was African-American in a predominantly white community?
He would have been the only African-American in that community, let's say that. I think the real problem they had was that they contaminated the crime scene so badly during the first 24 hours after the murders. During that period, they had 70-some people traipse through the master bedroom. There are two bathrooms in this house. The cops used one of the bathrooms that had blood in the sink. And this was another thing that indicated multiple perpetrators, because there was blood in both sinks. These guys, one washed up in one room and one or two washed up in another. But anyway, they're using that bathroom. Instead of putting in a porta-john outside like you would normally do, they go right in there. They eat at the Ryan's dining room table. They ate there at the Ryan's dining room table.
The cops.
And so 70-some people, including, you know, a lot of DA-type people and all the brass, everybody wanted to see this crime scene while the bodies were still there. They wanted to see this slaughter. they contaminated it so badly that, and then they sent over, this was a Sunday, so they don't have their top crew there, their top forensic crew, and they don't type the blood properly. They put the blood from all different parts of the room in the same bag. So there was no way to see, you know, to track the motions of, you know, of who died. What was the order of death? They had no clue about any of this stuff. So based on all that foul-up that they could, there was no reversing it. Their answer was to, on the second day after the murders, this would be a Monday, to start taking down the entire crime scene. They took the walls out. They took it down to the studs. They carted out all the furniture. They put it out on the front yard. Then they moved it to a warehouse where the air conditioner broke, and went to 120 degrees. This is, you know, June of 1983. They lose all the blood evidence in the warehouse. So they are now a C in terms of making any sense out of this case. So when Cooper comes along, it's like a godsend to them. They could just hang this on him and be done with it.
And what was the trial like? I mean, there was an illustration in your book of some clearly racist actions, at least around the trial.
60 people show up. Some bring their kids with them. This is like 9 o'clock at night when he's driven back to San Bernardino, to Ontario, which is the, you know, where the courthouse is and the jail. There's all this stuff about Fry, Kevin Cooper, and the first day at his arraignment, there's a toy ape hung in effigy outside that says, Hang Kevin the Ape. When he goes through his preliminary hearing, there's all kinds of very nasty racial signs outside. Another ape is hung, and there's a sign that says, Hang the Troglodyte. What they really portrayed him at was as a super predator, as a maniacal killer, which you would have to be if you saw this crime scene and these photos from the crime scene. You would have to be maniacal, and that's what they portrayed him to be, even though he was a two-bit burglar. He only went into homes that were empty or businesses that were empty. He was never armed during these times.
In fact, during his trial, an inmate in a California prison told authorities that his cellmate confessed to the Chino Hills murder, saying it was an Aryan Brotherhood hit.
He did.
Yeah.
Cooper, of course, was defended, being an indigent person, is defended by a public defender, which paid for by the county. He doesn't even stop the trial to go out and interview this guy. This is another Brady violation at this trial. They had this report for like 10 days before they turned it over to the defense, that there was this confession, alleged confession, at Vacaville, another prison in California. So the public defender should have stopped the trial. The judge invited him to. But it was the day that Cooper was to testify, and he didn't want to. He had Kevin all worked up, you know, to go. And so he doesn't stop the trial, and he sends his investigator out to see him, and hell, when they go to see the guy, he's in lockdown. He's been punished for causing any kind of waves during this trial. And they don't get very much out of him, but he does make the comment that if you heard what I heard, you would know that it was an Aryan Brotherhood hit, and they hit the wrong house. That's what the guy said.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Patrick O'Connor about his new book, Scapegoat, The Chino Hill Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper. He gets convicted. What's his sentence?
He gets the gas chamber.
He gets the gas chamber, and he gets convicted of four murders. Is that it?
He gets convicted of four murders and an attempted fifth. So,
and then there's appeals, et cetera.
There's lots of appeals.
And he wasn't executed.
He wasn't.
He came up for execution in 2004, February the 10th. He came within 3 hours and 45 minutes of being executed. He did the whole dead man walk. Late 2003, the Northern California Innocence Project at Santa Clara, they asked this big law firm, biggest law firm in San Francisco called Orrick, to take this case pro bono to see if they could stop the execution. And Orrick filed the necessary papers, and they went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This was a three-judge panel that declined it, but one of the judges on the panel is Judge Browning, who's the federal building, the federal courthouse in San Francisco, is named for Judge Browning. He's a senior judge now, but at the time he was still active, and he had a dissent already prepared, and he circulated it to all the rest of them, and en banc asked for the full court to vote on this request for stay of execution, and Judge Browning got enough votes to do it. So this is right down to the wire. This is February the 9th that this goes through. He's to be executed at midnight, you know, 12:01 on
2004.
2004. So it goes right down to the wire. And, of course, Bill Lockyer, the attorney general at the time, he appeals to the United States Supreme Court. So this day, the clock continues to tick. If the court, I think it was Sandra Day O'Connor, you know, you only get one judge of the Supreme Court will review this request for, you know, to turn over the stay. And she let it stand, the stay stand. And this entitled Cooper now to a whole new a successive habeas corpus hearing, evidentiary hearing in San Diego in front of Judge, Federal District Court Judge Marilyn Huff, who had already turned down his previous habeas corpus petitions. So those hearings took place in over a year, between 2004 and 2005. And Kevin Cooper had at least four items that would have granted almost anybody else a new trial.
So we have the situation of massive appeals, maybe more than one execution date, and he hasn't been executed yet today. But is his case still, does he still have a death penalty, and is he still possibly facing execution?
He would be. He would be dead by now. But there's been a moratorium on executions in California since 2006. By the way, Kenneth Starr, the of Watergate fame, he defended a death row client on the basis that the three-drug cocktail, the lethal injection protocol in California, is a violation of the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment.
At this point, that's why the hold is on, at least I recall
that's right.
That one reason. At this point, though, Cooper has still has a potential death penalty if and when they reinstate the death penalty in California.
He is, and he's fifth in line.
He's fifth in line.
And this moratorium will probably end in 2013. We know it can't end before then. And then there's a lot of anti-death penalty forces in California. I don't think it's going to happen in 2013 either. There'll be a lot of court battles over it.
Other than the public outrage at a wrongful conviction, if there is, or in your book and the effect on that, what's the next next stage of his actual case, and what can you recommend people to do?
I think writing to Governor Brown, Governor Jerry Brown, would be a very proactive thing for most people for people to do. Let him know that this is a big miscarriage of justice. The Orrick Law Firm, though, they are steadfast. They've hired a former 25-year veteran FBI guy to reinvestigate this whole case. And what they really want him to do is to go to, you know, this is 27 years down the road, to go back and try to use his ability to have cops talk to him and try to find out why they did this. What was their, how they did it, why they did it? Have some, you know, one or two of these cops talk so that Cooper would have newly discovered evidence that wasn't available previously. Because that's his big handicap right now is the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which cuts off almost all lines of appeal for a guy like Cooper.
Except for newly discovered evidence that couldn't have been discovered then.
That's right.
And that likely would have resulted in a favorable verdict for him.
That's right.
Now, whatever happened, this is maybe my last question, whatever happened to the other three guys who we believe were involved in the murder?
The number one guy, the convicted murderer, he now lives in Cape May, New Jersey. I'm told that one of them was dead, and I don't know about the other one. But I never was sure about the other two. I'm only really sure in my mind about the convicted murderer with the bloody coveralls and the...
What lesson do you draw from this awful story?
What it shows me is that this justice system is broken. The prosecutor and the sheriff's department, they have all the power. They can do anything they want to anybody. And it's not a question of one or two bad apples in this group. This is a whole corrupt department doing this. They had to have the help, the complicity of numerous people inside the sheriff's department and a very willing DA's office to perpetrate this fraud on Cooper.
Patrick O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, The Chino Hill Murders, and The Framing of Kevin Cooper. There was one surviving son of the Ryans who was 8 years old at the time, and I just opened your book and I saw a picture of him. Does he have any position on this?
Yeah, he does. He's become convinced over the years that Kevin Cooper was the lone attacker. And he made an impact statement at Kevin's habeas corpus deal that, you know, that this is the greatest nightmare of his life and he wants Kevin Cooper dead.
Wow.
I hope he reads your book, Patrick.
Right, so do I.
He did a review of it on Amazon. But all he did was publish his impact statement again.
Oh, really? Well, again, I know how much work it takes to do this. I know how much work he did on the book about Mamiya. And this one really seems, just incredible to me.
Who published the book?
Strategic Media Books out of South Carolina.
Again, it's called Scapegoat, The Chino Hill Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper. And if you've been listening to this show, you can hear how fascinating and incredible the facts are and how revelatory. So again, Scapegoat, The Chino Hill Murders and the Framing of Kevin Cooper.
Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Last month, we gave Mara Verheyden-Hilliard and Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice the Law and Disorder Tip of the Hat Award for creative use of the Freedom of Information Act. Documents obtained from the Department of Homeland Security suggest a massive nationwide monitoring, surveillance, and information sharing between DHS and local authorities. But it's only the tip of the iceberg. The documents are heavily redacted and don't show the full scale of coordination. Quote, these documents show not only intense government monitoring and coordination in response to the Occupy movement, but reveal a glimpse into the interior of a vast, tentacled national intelligence and domestic spying network that the U.S. government operates against its own people, says Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She's the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Mara joins us today to talk more about exposing the vast surveillance systems used against protesters. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been excited to read that you've secured some telling documents from the Department of Homeland Security. Can you give us an overview of your FOIA requests, what you hope to get, and what you have in fact received?
Yes. Well, we filed a series of FOIA requests and demands in November of last year when it was clear that the Occupy movement was being subjected to a coordinated assault all around the country. And we wanted to try and expose and uncover the role of the federal government working hand in hand with local police and municipalities to shut down this movement, and a movement that's inspiring people all over the country that really is an incredible force for social change and something we haven't seen for a long time. And we filed these requests at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, also on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee, and we were also then joined by the author and filmmaker Michael Moore in these demands. So we've now been starting to get a return on these documents, and while we think what we have is really only the tip of a very carefully submerged iceberg, what we're seeing alone makes it clear that there is massive surveillance, coordination, monitoring of peaceful protesters all over the country by the federal government. Some of the materials we have come from the Department of Homeland Security, which shows that its National Operations Center, which is described as the national level hub for situational awareness, terrorism, incident reporting, the conduit for reporting to the White House Situation Room, is engaged in mass monitoring and collection of data of demonstrators, that there is monitoring that's gone on from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta to El Paso to Detroit to Dallas, that there is an intense focus going all the way up to high-ranking members of the administration. And we think that this really says a lot, too, about the Obama administration's willingness to continue really the policies that were put in place by the Bush administration in terms of a mass domestic spying apparatus in the United States.
Can you talk a little bit about how you think local municipalities are cooperating with the federal government, or are they sharing information? Are they taking orders from high up?
Well, we know that with the creation of the fusion centers and suspicious activity reporting, and really the sort of the vertical integration of law enforcement intelligence operatives in the United States, that coming from a federal level, from the Department of Homeland Security with billions of dollars, there is in place a mechanism where kind of all of the hundreds of thousands of law enforcement officers in the United States, both local law enforcement as well as federal, are kind of local is almost deputized into a federal position where they're feeding information, collecting data in joint task force and joint terrorism task force and as fusion center operatives. That's kind of going into this like mass juggernaut of spying. And once you have that structure in place, you almost begin to blur the lines between the two. Now, when it comes to raiding an encampment and the people who are actually physically walking out there with clubs and handcuffs and guns, it's going to be the local law enforcement authorities. But they're not detached or not integrated into, at this point, a sort of federal law enforcement apparatus. And what we're trying to get at is the level of communication, the level of coordination, the level of direction, in part because we think it's critical that the people of the United States are able to see this. This is the way that this can be stopped, is to uncover it and expose it. And the people have the right to demand an end to these practices.
So initial hysteria after 9/11, when the Patriot Act was passed and the authorization to use military force and the beginnings of the militarization of the police departments, now chickens are coming home to roost, I suppose, because instead of using this whole apparatus that's been created in the last 10 years to defend the American people against terrorist attacks from abroad, it's actually being aimed at the social justice movement here in this country.
Well, we see time and again, you know, the FBI creating their own terrorist plots, you know, in many ways as PR to justify their repressive apparatus and to keep people sort of scared, except that over and over again, it's the FBI that's like made up the plots, brought in, you know, some hapless people to join them with it. And they were doing that targeting the Muslim community. But now we see in the last, you know, couple of weeks that they're doing this more and more targeting people that they see around the Occupy movement. And I really believe that one of the defining features of the Obama administration is the fact that it took on this apparatus put in place by the Bush administration and not only didn't try and take it apart or expend any political capital to try and end it, they have deepened it and they have embraced it. There is really a structure now in the United States that has the U.S. government really just spying and collecting data on its own citizens?
In fact, they've actually codified into law certain practices that were being undertaken during the Bush administration, the NDAA and other pieces of legislation.
Yes, there is a growing deepening, too, of the use of military in civilian affairs. And we see, you know, regulations that have come into place under the Obama administration where there is growing use of military support for domestic civilian authorities, which is very, very concerning. And part of the reason that I think that this is happening is because the administration knows that it can count on the silence and the acquiescence of the liberals that are supporting them, who are now, you know, going to drive people back into the ballot box and say that that's the basis for social change, not being in the streets. But I think we can see from the last 4 years that the real spark for social change is going to come because of people actually getting together in collective action.
I think the Occupy movement infused the social justice movement with a new energy. We at many points seem to be in danger of losing some of that. And one of the things we hoped you could speak about is your success in actually holding the police accountable in different jurisdictions around the country for unlawful practices, unlawful crowd control policies. You've not only won some large settlements, but affected long-term changes in how police departments go about their work. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, our view here organizationally at the PCJF is that what we want to accomplish is to be able to basically keep the streets and the sidewalks and the parkland open for grassroots democracy, for social change. And people need to have the ability to come out and to be able to come together and to be able to do that without fear that they're going to be beaten and suddenly mass arrested, because it has a huge impact, obviously, on people, not only to those who are subject to it, but to all those who are thinking, I too want to join this movement. I mean, there's so many people, millions and millions, tens of millions of people in the United States suffering because of the extreme economic inequality and social inequality, who want to be able to come out, who want to be able to speak out, but will be, you know, justifiably concerned because they can't afford to go to jail. And so what we try to do is bring litigation that looks at the particular police conduct, the police tactics that are illegal, and we try to dismantle those tactics and to disarm the police of illegal tactics. So, for example, in D.C., we were successful in stopping the police from being able to use the different tactics they use to conduct mass false arrests, to trap and detain people, to surround people with police lines and then arrest them without probable cause. And it was really kind of a step-by-step dissection. And we've now also brought a class action lawsuit for the Brooklyn Bridge mass arrests in New York.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
hoping to achieve the same thing, because the idea that if you're out in the streets and you're demonstrating and that you can suddenly just be completely surrounded by the police and be given no order, and there's no order that you're disobeying and no opportunity to disperse, and suddenly, you know, you're handcuffed and jailed. If that was happening in any other country, you know, the State Department, Hillary Clinton, she'd be wagging her finger. Well, depending on which country. If it's a country that the U.S. didn't like, you know, Bahrain would be fine. But anywhere else, you know, then you would have these reactions. But here in the U.S., the ability of police to be able to do that in Oakland and New York and D.C., these are things that have to be able to stop so that the movement has space to breathe and to grow.
Mara, we're facing the political conventions in late August, early September. What do you think we have to look forward to there?
Well, these are all national special security events, which means that the Secret Service and the federal government becomes the lead coordinating arm, and local police sort of work under that umbrella. I think that's an umbrella that's now very actually common in many respects for major events, but as a formal status at these events. And I think what we'll see is a lot of what we've already seen. I think in Tampa and in Charlotte, you know, you can see that they're enacting these very restrictive, repressive ordinances that just, you know, facially look unconstitutional. But, of course, the question is whether a judiciary or a conservative judiciary will agree with that, you know, and people certainly are planning challenges to those ordinances. And I don't think we know at this point how many people are going to be coming out into the streets, but certainly I would expect there to be a significant level of police repression, both preemptively in terms of trying to scare people away by restricting the ability of people to engage in completely lawful activity. I mean, that's sort of the notable thing about the ordinances. I mean, the ordinances are basically trying to stop people from doing things that are permitted, that are lawful, that are peaceful at the outset. And we obviously are concerned, and we're working, and I'm co-chair of the Guild's Mass Defense Committee, and Mass Defense Committee members are working in all these localities to try and provide support for the movement on the ground, to look at ordinance challenges, and to be prepared to respond in rapid response if we're seeing things like mass arrests or raids.
Mara, an issue that we've heard about, and I hope you can address, is competition for local anti-terrorism funding and how that informs a lot of the development of the partnerships between local and national, how it informs local police department's response to big protests. What role does this government funding provide?
The anti-terrorism funding, you know, of the last dozen years, it looks a lot like kind of the war on drugs funding. So when you have, you create sort of the scare tactic among people in the United States, and that's not to say that terrorism is not something to be scared of, but I think we also have to recognize the breadth or the reality of the threat or where something is being used as a pretext. And so with the war on drugs, it was, you know, to get the acquiescence in a way of people in the United States, and now, you know, after September 11th, to get the acquiescence of people to spend vast portions of their money on police, on military, you know, while at the same time social programs are being cut, where funding for education is being cut, where, you know, tens of millions of people can't go to a doctor, and yet, you know, there's endless bombs, there's endless handcuffs, there's an endless supply of funds for this. And when the money is pouring out like that, and pouring out now in the terrorism, anti-terrorism so-called context, then you have this huge funding for hundreds of thousands of law enforcement officers in the United States who are being told to find an enemy. And when you have all these people kind of searching for an enemy, they're going to find one. And that, at the moment, is also going to be, you know, the movement of people who are in the streets. I mean, the response we see is really kind of a paramilitary response a lot of the time. And there's a lot of money going into that, as well as the political motivation to stop something that could so dramatically change the balance in the United States.
Talk about the militarization, not just the coordination from top to bottom of the police forces, but the militarization of the police forces.
The police in the last decades have really begun using paramilitary police tactics. I think this has been most profoundly felt in oppressed communities, in Black and Latino communities, where the police come in like a little army. You know, they throw people up against the wall, and, you know, you look at New York City with Stop and Frisk, which is, you know, a completely racist venture. And all around the United States, people have felt this, and we see it also then in the context of demonstrations, where the police are using paramilitary tactics, where they really sort of look at civilians almost as a military enemy. They're not, fortunately, taking out guns and shooting people, and I'm not equating it to that, but I think in terms of the basic tactics we use, the view of the police against demonstrators, it definitely has that feeling of the use of some measure of force and the view that they are an enemy, that this is an activity that's criminal, that has to be stopped, that has to be shut down, that the people have to be taken off the streets, instead of looking at demonstrations as a cherished, fundamental First Amendment right that should be supported.
Mara, we had recently all around the country and here in New York for May Day, at least 10 to 30,000 people marching from Union Square down to Wall Street, and very little media coverage of that. What do you think of the corporate media's failure to cover successful large mass demonstrations?
I think at different points the media picks up on something, and they picked up on the Occupy movement last fall, and they were assigning staff. There were people who were being given the Occupy beat, and that's very rare for the movement to have that, to have the corporate media actually assigning people to pay attention and to write on it, report on it. So reporters were looking for stories. And, you know, if you think about the anti-war demonstrations of the last decade, I mean, we were having mass demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people in the street, and frequently you couldn't even get into the A section. I mean, you were lucky if you got, like, metro coverage, and that's hundreds of thousands of people. Or even, you know, or when we had demonstrations, you know, in Washington with the reinvasion of Gaza, there were tens of thousands of people, and, you know, the Washington Post was not going to cover it. So at points, at different points, there's always a political decision being made. Now, I'm not sitting on the board of the newspapers or the, you know, networks, or you don't know exactly what they're thinking, but obviously I think from the right-wing point of view, they don't want to cover the movement, and now from the liberal point of view, there's probably less of a desire to cover the movement because there's going to be a desire simply to focus on voting for Obama again as, you know, the only hope for change.
Well, I think they make a calculation. If something's so huge and obvious and they don't cover it at all, it takes away from their credibility. So then they've got to figure out to what extent they're going to cover it. And so you get kind of grudging coverage sometimes. But I remember back in the huge demonstrations against the war in Vietnam and in Washington, D.C. in 67 and 69, where we had 500,000 people, biggest demonstrations in the history of the United States up until then. You'd get scanty coverage. They'd underestimate. They'd take a Parks Department estimation of the crowd. They would really play it down. But I do agree with you. The Occupy Wall Street phenomena was something that they really couldn't ignore. Otherwise, they'd look like what they are, the press of Wall Street.
Mara, do you see a trend in the privatization of public spaces such as parks and traditional fora for protest and free speech?
There is, and we see it in a couple different ways. There is growing effort to take public space really out from under our feet, and one way of doing that is to say that, you know, there's going to be an effort to sort of restore the grass. And we fought this battle back in 2004 at the RNC in New York when we came in to challenge the effort of New York City to ban mass assembly on the Great Lawn of Central Park and successfully challenge that. But at the time, I mean, they were arguing that, you know, free speech would hurt the grass. You know, I mean, first of all, if it does hurt the grass grows back. Free speech doesn't. But if you want to take that point, I mean, we went through deposition after deposition where, in the end, they were basically arguing that having tens of thousands of people from the Philharmonic, you know, even if it, like, rained, sitting on the lawn drinking wine was not going to hurt the grass. But if someone was staying on the stage giving a political speech, then somehow the grass was going to be more hurt by the people who were using it. I mean, it was that ridiculous. And we see that now in Washington, D.C., with the National Mall. There's an effort to create, there is a public-private trust where now you have the extreme wealthy, the 1%, becoming the caretakers of what is our public space. And that's a very dangerous trend. And as we see that, it's something that we take on and that I think that, you know, everyone has to challenge.
Mara, what about crowd control with the interlocking steel fences, the demonstration areas where people are supposed to go, the law that says you can't demonstrate anywhere near the president? Talk to us about those tactics.
Well, those are tactics that we've seen for quite some time, or certainly over the last 10 years. But it's the, you know, again, it's sort of this view of demonstration as a criminal, necessarily criminal or, you know, enemy event, when of course it's not. And you have people coming out who want to protest, and they want to push them out of sight and sound. And, you know, to the extent they're there, I mean, putting people in pens, I mean, it makes it look like it's a dangerous or bad activity. It also makes it impossible for people to join a demonstration or leave a demonstration. It kind of quarantines it. I mean, it does quarantine it. But we also saw that with the inaugurations in D.C., which is a long-running battle that we've been litigating here, inauguration after inauguration, which we've had success with. But every 4 years, the National Park Service, which is supposed to be the neutral steward of public space, comes in and tries to privatize the inaugural parade route on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is called America's Main Street for good reason, and set it aside only for the donors and the supporters of the incoming administration of the government, so that they can basically sanitize the parade route and make it, you know, look like, you know, to the world media and to everyone else as if everyone's only cheering for the president, and try and keep out those that would have a different point of view. And then, you know, that's another way that we see this effort to kind of not have the people of the United States, not have the people of the world see that there really is a movement and that there are other people that they can come out and join. I think a lot of this is overarching effort to try and make people feel like they need to suffer alone and suffer in silence, when the logical thing is when your economic condition is as bad as it is for so many people, you want to make it better. And if you can see that there are other people who are out there trying to make it better, you're going to go join them. But if the media and the government can sanitize the streets and stop the coverage and, you know, make you think that you just have to stay at home and suffer and nothing will change for you, that's what they're going to do.
We want to thank you and the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund for the really relentless work that you've done to help ensure that free speech still has a voice in this country.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you both for having such a really great show. It's just a voice that you don't hear anywhere else.
Thanks so much, Mara. We'll get back to you after you win your victory in New York City on the bridge protesters. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.